Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Professor James Hudnut Boimler, the Ann Potter Wilson Distinguished Professor of American Religious History at Vanderbilt University, where he also served as Dean of the Divinity School from 2000 until 2013. Dr. Hudnut Boimler's current academic interests include the historiography of religion in the American South, 19th and 20th century American religious history, the use of non-textual evidence in studying religion, and religion and philanthropy. Prior to coming to Vanderbilt in 2000, he was the dean of the faculty at Columbia Theological Seminary, a program associate for the Lilly Endowment, and director of the undergraduate program in public and international affairs at Princeton University. Dr. Hudnut Boimler is the author of several books, including Looking for God in the Suburbs, The Religion of the American Dream and Its Critics, 1945 to 1965, Generous Saints, Congregations Rethinking Money and Ethics, and most recently, In Pursuit of the Almighty's Dollar, A History of Money and American Protestantism, which he finished writing while serving as dean, an impressive accomplishment as administrative offices are usually where faculty go to intellectually extinguish themselves, but not Jim. Jim also co-authored The History of the Riverside Church in the City of New York. And when he is not writing, administrating, or professing, Reverend Hudnut Boimler and his wife Heidi are both Presbyterian ministers making their home in Nashville, a much more musically robust town than Princeton, I might add. Yeehaw! Jim, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks. It's great to talk with you this morning.
Yeah, you have a really interesting career that took you from Princeton to Nashville at one point, and that's a move that many academics might be reluctant to make, because once you're at an Ivy League, it's basically saying that you have arrived, but you arrived there and then you headed south. So I have to ask, are you a country music aficionado or a fan of SEC football? How'd you end up getting to Vanderbilt?
Well, first of all, Nashville is one of the most genuinely culturally interesting places I've ever lived, and is an incredibly interesting place to do American religious history, insofar as this is a place where black American religious history is centrally located, where Methodist and Baptist Southern history and Church of Christ history kind of converges, and where a kind of mountain and Midwest also come together. But I arrived here, as many academics do, because a good job and the opportunity to be in both theological education and university education were here in the year 2000.
Very cool. I have to admit that I love Nashville, and I know a lot of people might say that Nashville's not all that culturally interesting, but I just find it absolutely fascinating. It's a much larger city than most people think it is, but I happen to love that four square block area where all the bars stay open all the time and have country music, so great place to be. Your profile interests me as you recently wrote a book entitled In Pursuit of the Almighty's Dollar, which I have to say slipped my attention until about a month ago when I read one of your articles over at Real Clear Religion. And I myself am one of the scholars within, and I think an early adopter of this theoretical perspective called the economics of religion, which is not strictly limited to studying money and churches, as many people might think. There's some other aspects to it. But you also wrote a short piece for the Proceedings of the Second Biennial Conference on Religion and American Culture that discussed the value of this economic analysis for interpreting American religious behavior. And that piqued my attention because somebody from outside the perspective, so to speak, is kind of giving us an analysis of what we're doing. So give us your take on this perspective, this economics of religion, and also how did you stumble into this area of inquiry?
Well, in the piece, I tell the story of being a very young academic working with undergraduates at the Woodrow Wilson School right after my religion program as a graduate student. And so I was surrounded by people who did political science and did economics. And I was at the cafeteria in the school with some other faculty members. And one whom I didn't know, but had recently been appointed to full professor, sat down with some of the younger faculty. And he said, you do religion, right? And I said, yes. He said, I can explain that. And I said, go ahead. And he said, religion always has more women in it than men. I said, that's almost always true, yes. And he said, that's because all prayers are equal before God, and therefore they're working at their comparative advantage. Out in the workaday world, their work isn't compensated at a fair or equal value, but before God, their work does count that way. So when I asked, where do you get this? And he said, Gary Becker from the University of Chicago, who'd explained religion and family relationships, and it could be reduced to an absurdity, or there's actually something there. And underneath the sort of funny anecdote, and let me tell you that the faculty member was Ben Bernanke, and he who was later to become chairman of the Fed, and he was a good-natured guy about religion and about any big idea, and so we had a nice chat about how this big idea might influence interpretation of things that weren't strictly money and banking, trade balances, and what have you.
I guess Ben Bernanke actually did pretty well for himself then. So he turned out to be a big name. You must have had some influence on him getting to the Fed, I would assume.
I don't think I had any influence, but I think the fact that he studied the Great Depression served us all pretty well. I think the other thing that enabled me to stay in the conversation was I had taken a whole bunch of economics classes in college, and they had already made me think of things beyond national accounts balances and the firm as in a private firm in economic terms. So I was already thinking about what is a philanthropic or a not-for-profit activity up to.
Now, you mentioned also in this short piece for the proceedings that the economic approach actually offers some nice possibilities for people who are more humanities inclined. And that was very warming to my heart, because I oftentimes come across the folks from religious studies programs that look at me and they say, oh, economics or religion, you just must be so reductionist that you just think that it's all about the money. And I try to explain that it's not. But what things do you think that the economics of religion approach adds to somebody who's in the humanities?
Well, so So one of the biggest crossover points is value. Humanistic scholars always want to talk about what people value. And as somebody who's studied a lot of Protestants, I read sermons that articulate values that that preachers say their listeners should value. But I've, like every other historian, I've always wondered, what did the listeners think? And so by using an economic approach, I can begin asking behavioral questions about, are they buying this, without actually having literary evidence in every one of Jonathan Edwards' members' churches to see, are they buying it so much that they're paying him more, or repainting the church, or doing so. The evidence is, are they anteing up more money because it's worth more to them? Are they supporting new mission activities? One of the common things that you find throughout 250 years of American religious history is ministers will privately grumble that they're not being well taken care of by their people. And one of the things I wanted to see was this true or just a usual complaint of any knowledge worker that valued their work more than some other people?
Oh, yeah.
Professors feel that way.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, academics always feel like we're underpaid, and the value that we bring to the world is just so immense that we should be, manna from heaven should just be coming down on our heads. Yeah, I really like the fact that you emphasized just a minute ago that the fact that there's an exchange relationship between a pastor and the congregation, and that the pastor has a specialty in providing knowledge about God, about the theology, and the parishioners could contribute in money, but you also mentioned something else like painting the building or volunteering to clean up the grounds. Those are part of the things that we quote unquote buy when we buy religion. That's how we buy it. It's not just money per se, but it's also our volunteer time, our effort that we put into it, and that really reflects this exchange relationship.
Exactly. You know, I'll give you a little tidbit from the book that fascinated me, that during several of the panics and recessions and depressions, really, before the Great Depression. So think basically from the 1870s through World War I. It was fascinating to me how much people kept paying their pledges through hard times. Religion was valuable to them in these churches. We have economic data to suggest that it was really important to them. Where clergy didn't do so well was after times got better again.
Mm-hmm.
I never expected to see that. I expected to see a downturn more proximate to the economic reversals for the parishioners.
Give us a little hint. Why do you think that is? And then I want to dip into your book and take it all the way back to the 1700s where you start. But why do you think people drop their participation or their financial participation following the Great Depression?
So I think they dropped it. They didn't drop it. They kept it nominally level. So the real purchasing power after a panic or a depression flattened out. So if you were giving $2 a week, you kept giving $2 a week, but then what happens after a depression is that the money, once the price and wage levels begin to rise, don't go as far. And I think people, it's hard to know exactly the psychology, but they may feel they sacrificed a long time and they're still being faithful at the $2 a week level. And it takes a long time to catch up with the chief employee of the institution.
Yeah, a fascinating observation there. Again, you know, prices oftentimes tend to be sticky, and so this might be a case of it, and kind of a reverse case of it. Is that, you know, $2 was pretty good 5 years ago, so it should be pretty good for you now during better times. But interesting thing to look into there. Let's go ahead and dip into your book. The book is titled In Pursuit of the Almighty's Dollar, and it is a historical tour of American Protestant congregations from roughly the time of the U.S. founding, mid-18th century, to maybe up to 1800 or so, then up to present times. And I have to admit, I really enjoyed this book. I first picked it up through our interlibrary loan on an electronic copy, and I liked it so much that I actually went to Amazon and got the regular print copy, because I'm older and I tend to like print copies. So I urge folks to get this. It's in the vein of some of the best books, historical books I've read by Philip Jenkins and Tommy Kidd and a few other folks, because it has this really nice theoretical stream that strings all the way through history. And so that is what we want to tackle here. But before we do that, let's kind of start to talk about some of the foundational issues before the history. Why is it important to look at how churches fund themselves?
Well, I think there was a reason behind the reason. What piqued my curiosity was when I worked at Lilly Endowment, we started an initiative called Financing American Religion. And it was founded because we kept getting people banging at the door saying, help fund our ministry, help fund our church, help fund our denomination. And we wanted to know what's going on. And we kept looking for somebody to do a historical dimension to that research, not just what's going on now, but the most important historical question is, and how does what's going on now compare to how it's been? And so why it's important to understand how churches have funded themselves is to understand, is what we're seeing qualitatively and quantitatively different than what's gone on in the past. And I chose to go back to 1750 into the colonial era when most of the congregations in what later became the United States were supported by a variety of taxes and or glebe lands in the case of Anglican churches. And then see what happened when what Kelly Olds called a great privatization took place. Churches were kind of kicked off the government payroll, largesse, and had to become volunteer supported within the space of a half generation.
Yeah, you mentioned the Kelly Olds piece, and that's an article that I had come across in my own research, and I just absolutely loved it, and it was just delightful to find that somebody else picked up on it, because it's just a really fun piece to talk about how churches had to figure out very quickly how to fund themselves when the state wasn't dropping bags of cash at their doorstep. It was very cool. So one of the things that I'm interested in with historians is how they actually do the research on this kind of thing. And at the outset of your book, you make a really interesting statement that you come from this historical school of thought where you think it's better to look at somebody's checkbook than their diary to understand that person. Now, what do you mean by that? And how did you get some of the evidence from 200, 250 years ago?
Well, why do I say that? Because there's a wonderful book, Belief and Behavior, that was done, I don't know, maybe approaching 30 years ago, that's got a number of case studies, and it does just that. It approaches things using sociology, political science, history, and counts things using social science methods in religion. I was always very impressed how they got at religious behaviors of historical subjects and cast light on things. The other thing is being a theological educator, being a minister, being raised in a minister's household and around religious rhetoric, I know that people will say all kinds of, it's almost like marketing things. They will put a good shine on how they want to present things or what they want you to believe. But I, as a historian, am interested in not just that, but what's actually going on in their lives.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant approach to take in terms of this, and one that is close to my own theoretical understanding and methodological understanding of the world. The concern, though, and when I teach the economics of religion to students, and I'm always concerned about this, is that this kind of approach could lead to a very cynical read of the study of church founding or funding, where one basically comes to the conclusion that religion's just a con game to separate people from their money. And you note that there is a materialization of religion, and that is inevitable, but it doesn't necessarily lead one down the path towards spiritual nihilism or atheism, to so to speak. And in your preface, you note that this is a tale of the best intentions, unintended consequences, and surprising outcomes. How do you approach this issue of money, and what do you mean by all of that? How should individuals keep the relationship between money and religion in its proper context?
Well, I think I personally think that some of the to answer the last question first, I think that people involved in religion, either from the leadership standpoint or the followership standpoint, might do best to have a very direct conversation on about what's this, what is this worth to you, and why, on spiritual and humanitarian and philanthropic grounds. Why are you helping others? Why are you supporting a church to support the spiritual nurture and education of children and adults and the elderly? That honesty is actually a better policy. And the folks who, for instance, invented almost out of whole cloth, it seems to me, the idea that the tithe in Malachi had never been repealed and applied to everyone throughout time, that it applied to Christians, not just to ancient Hebrews, were engaging in some P.T. Barnum-esque kind of fundraising that I, you know, just can't admire from where I sit ethically. And the interesting thing is, of course, if the clergy stand up there and preach the tithe, but only raise 4% of the congregation's income, because some tithe, some give a half tithe, and a whole lot of people give 1 or 2%, and some give nothing, then there's a lot of disaffection going on between the leadership and the followership. And you ask, you know, how did I find that throughout time? These 18th century and 19th century and 20th century folks, in particular denominations, kept extraordinary records. They counted everything.
Okay, so let's go ahead and dive into the book here and walk through it again. It's a history tale that takes us into several different historical eras in the United States, and you start the study in 1750. So let me ask you why you did that. What is going on at the time, and what big changes are coming in the latter half of the 18th century in terms of church funding?
Yeah, so one of the first things that happens happens even before disestablishment, and that is the Great Awakening in New England and beyond establishes competition in space between the most traditional, most established churches and evangelical itinerant preachers who will stand outside your congregation on Sunday morning and preach that you don't have the gospel, but he does, and begin to acquire followers. And the other thing is, as the communities begin to get large and divide, there's a sort of a crisis of the people 5 miles out want a church of their own. So we begin seeing a kind of a breakdown for the Puritans of both a standing, what was called the standing order, and then we see the kind of competition that will drive American religiosity right down to today in 2017. So, towards the end of the book, I say, now in America, you can have just as much of religion as someone is willing to pay for. You don't have to pay for it yourself if somebody else is willing to pay for it. But that already is beginning to start in the 1750s.
You also note at this period of time that three ironies or observations are arising at this time, and you weave these ironies or these observations throughout the text. Discuss these three quote-unquote ironic themes and why you see them as somewhat ironic.
So one is that the clergy who raised the money for God knew that this was largely in their own interest, that a very stable figure over time was that two-thirds of the cost of running a congregation was for personnel. And, you know, European clergy didn't have to say, give your money in this offering for God, or through this subscription, or through this pew rent. They didn't have to become barkers for God, but know that it was coming to them. The second one was that they spiritualized giving to as a kind of a sleight of hand, as it were, to get away from things like pew rents. But it also was connected to the benevolent empire of orphanages and abolition societies and temperance societies, which also created more needs for funds and created a kind of competition for funds, created a much larger religious philanthropic sector. You know, the Methodist Church had something like four times as many employees as the post office at the eve of the Civil War. And finally, you know, the last irony is the voluntary nature of church finance meant that individual congregations could secure their own future, which meant that we could become over-churched and more competitive.
Rarely do you hear somebody say the word over-churched in America. So what do you mean by that?
Well, so there's a there are churches in every on every corner in some intersections here in Nashville and in some places out in our outlying counties. And some of those churches are not doing well, and they wonder why. And part of what happens is they actually don't represent the people in that particular community, but they represent a kind of entrepreneurial effort to plant something that didn't actually take off.
Interesting. One of the other things that you mentioned earlier on, a term called pew rent, and this is something that you see in the 18th century. Many people are not familiar with that term. What does it mean, pew rent?
So, one of the very first things to be implemented, and it actually began to be used in the late colonial period, was to charge an amount for each pew for the seating of one's family. The closer to the pulpit, and usually to the heat source, which was important during the winter, those pews were more important. There were free. There was a place for widows that didn't cost anything, and there were a few undesirable cheap pews for poor people in the back. And this was true of Congregationalists and Episcopalians, Presbyterians and Methodists until two movements got going. One was Charles Grandison Finney made it unfashionable in his preaching in New York City by saying all pews will be free. The gospel should not be conditioned upon coming to a particular particular seat. And then he still took an offering that was promoted by an emotional tenor to give and continue this ministry, as it were. The other thing is that the Free Methodists broke away from the Methodists and kind of shamed everybody by saying that they stood for free grace, free bodies, as in no slavery, and free pews. And that idea, a more democratic, less sort of aristocratic notion, swept the churches. The Episcopalians and some big city Presbyterians were probably the last to give up pew rents, and they were the last to do so in the early 20th century.
I can just see a paper written on this topic with the title "Closer to God and the Radiator," It comes out in your book, but I can just see a separate standalone. I always look for good titles for articles, and you know, where everybody says, "Well, I want to be closer to God," but you know, it's that radiator there in December becomes really important. So,
yeah, I mean, that's one of those reasons the boxes were so high. Some churches did not have common stoves. Many cases, you brought heated bricks. And you put them in a little metal box inside those boxed pews that you see in recreated churches.
Today, when you go out to the East Coast, you deal, go into some of the older churches, you do still see nameplates on some of the pews. I know some of this just might be a charitable donation that was made in the last half century or so, but I can still see the echoes of a pew rent that echoes through the ages, I guess.
Well, so at Old Ship, Hingham, Mass., you can see a restoration that takes it back to the 17th century, and they had enough of the old doors that we have the first family of that building's chairs. And what you have is, in essence, evidence of a capital campaign to build those. To pay for that building, and effectively set the families in their pews, and then they would have been paying an annual upkeep in addition to their town taxes.
Now, as you mentioned, a capital campaign for buildings, that takes us into the next segment of your book, where you talk about the period roughly from about 1800 to the Civil War, so roughly about 1860 or so. There's a number of things going on here. We talked about the decline of the pew rental system just a minute ago and the privatization of funding. But there's also other things going on, such as the increase in voluntarism or charitable organizations, as you call the benevolent empire, and also changes in the rhetorics surrounding tithing. Give us a sense of what is going on in the first half of the 19th century.
Well, in the first half of the 19th century, and are we focusing, you want to focus on the built environment particularly?
Yeah, that would be great, because you mentioned buildings, and that was one of the interesting components of that chapter that we often don't think about. We think of religion as being theologies, but there's buildings associated with this thing, and they started to transform the landscape at this period of time. So go ahead and talk about that.
So one of the things I thought, but found myself corrected by the architectural and historical record, was that people built buildings in the 17th and 18th and 19th century, and then they just kept living in them all the while, so that church on the New England Green that looks so old and pretty and white has been there all that time. The most photographed church in the United States is the Congregational Church in Litchfield, Connecticut. But would you believe that's not the original church? It looks like a grand version of the original church, but in between there was an ugly Gothic church from the 19th century. And that led me in this first buildings chapter to talk about how people build when they must, and when they can, and it seems to go about every generation. And this is an example of the materialization of religion. There seems to be something devotional going on. We built this church that has a mixed element of pride of what you've done with your hands and a devotion towards God. And you're building it with not only a sort of idea of what a church should look like for God, but you're also building it with an idea of the refinements or simplicity that go with your idea of God in your particular time. So that church in Hingham, Mass. That I talked about went through almost a dozen improvements before, in the 1930s, they took it back to the way it looked in the 17th century. And I found this again and again. So people built when a church burned down, or the population had to relocate, or the next generation came along and said, you know, this would really look better if, all of which I find fascinating, you know, because it's a work of a certain kind of lay polity to make a temple with one's hands. And I also think that it's something that in religious history we ascribe to other people, but not Protestants. You know, Protestants are aniconic. They don't care about this kind of stuff. Oh, yeah, let's talk about church buildings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see how that, you know, today we think about that because a lot of Protestant upstart sects are actually located in shopping malls and things like this. But I bet if we track those over time, you would see this desire to have your own building, to have your own imprint on your congregation.
There are very few 1970s coffee house ministries that are still in coffee houses, but some of them are still going. You know, and they're proud of where they are because it fits their notion of their ministry.
So big capital campaigns had to occur for these buildings during this period of time. The other thing that's going on in the first half of the 19th century is this rise in the benevolence empire, as you call it, or these charitable foundations. How is that affecting the funding of religion, and how is that shaking up the environment now?
So ministers and lay elites who get a passion about something, temperance. Now you got to remember, at this time in the early 19th century, we're moving from an agricultural economy to the beginnings of an industrial economy and a wage-earning economy. And Americans consumed an enormous amount of whiskey, but it did terrible things to the family. People also lost a lot of lost children, but children lost parents too. So we had orphanages, we had old age homes, we had temperance societies, we had a desire to help the poor, and we had a desire to give the poor tracts so that they could learn about God and become devote their lives to Christ and become middle class. They didn't say middle class, but there's some of that in there. Now, every one of these societies was founded either independently or by a church, had its own board, and often had coal porters, people who went around passing out tracts. The tracts were the internet of, they were pamphlets that were the internet of the early 19th century. The literature would be shared, usually with a church, where the person would speak and then ask for money. Now, the competition here is the minister needs money for the church. The church needs money for the church. And if you're giving 12 or 23 weeks a year to all these good causes, some of which are denominational, some of which are local, and some of which are regional, it becomes a problem with agents of these various philanthropic societies. So they begin evolving things like coordinated appeals, where the church develops a mission budget, and they try to put these agents out of business and put them under denominational or ecumenical umbrellas.
Yeah, fascinating changes going on. And again, your book picks up these really subtle nuances that you wouldn't think have a big concern. A lot of people have written about the benevolence empire, but you really, you have to stop and think, well, what are the consequences of this? Yes, they're chipping into what the minister would be getting for his own salary. And as you mentioned right up front, this is 2/3 of a church's personnel. And if you start to see that wither, you're going to start to see the organization itself wither. So that becomes an issue. Now, you take this up to the Civil War, and then you note that during the Civil War in the United States, a very disruptive period, and there were fewer records about church findings. So there's kind of a little area of history for about 5 years or so that we didn't have much information. But then the next phase you examine, it comes in this area from the 1850 to about 1920, or I should say 1860 or 1870 to 1920. What is happening with church financing during this time?
So, two big stories kick in. One is rediscovering tithing and promoting stewardship. Tithing, that is, saying that God commands 10% of everyone be given to God's house and purposes. And this is a transatlantic import. This began with tithing sermon contests in the United Kingdom that get picked up through the Methodist Atlantic connection, and pretty soon tithing is being preached in the United States. At the same time, the idea of stewardship, that God is the owner, human beings are the steward of what they have, and therefore in all of life they need to support what God wants, not what they want, is beginning to be preached. And a whole literature of how to get your congregation to tithe and how to get your people to see themselves as stewards really burgeons. Cokesbury and Abingdon books out of both New York and Nashville produced most of this literature. And at the same time, clergy begin to become and see themselves more as professionals rather than sort of evangelists or gentlemen. So they're more of the how-to literature serves their kind of new identity.
It's interesting about these professionalization of clergy, and your book talks about different models that arise during this period of time of how clergy should be paid or compensated. Two of the ones that really fascinated me were the Presbyterian model and then also Lutherans and how they developed a pension system. Give us a little clue of how things are evolving here.
Well, so the interesting thing is that two of the stronger denominations, the Presbyterians and the United Lutherans, the largest church at that time, began evolving a kind of philosophy that was both tacit and sometimes actually said, and I catch them saying what their philosophy is in the book. For the Presbyterians, even when they sent somebody on the mission field, they supplemented the salary so that it was as good as a school superintendent in a more settled place. So you might be in a brand new mission church in Kansas with 12 members, and you were making what you might make in a very settled town in Iowa. And their National Missions Board was sending out an extra $500 to bring you up to $1,200 when $1,200 was a lot of money. The Lutherans, on the other hand, were paying what you everybody an equal and decent retirement, such that their ministers, their pastors, could retire with dignity. And it was their, well done, good and faithful servant. Now you may retire to your reward without fear of having to go into some old age home or something like that. So they had a strong sense of this is what we owe to our pastors that they put into place. And all that contrasts, I suppose, with the Methodists that had created the bigger the church you go to, the bigger the salary you get. And if you're a good enough preacher, you'll move up. And if not, maybe you'll move down to increasing number of churches to be responsible for, just like when you started out.
I want to condense the next two chapters of your book, which cover the interwar period and post-war period up to the 1980s. So we're talking about roughly the 1920s to the 1980s. What is happening during this era?
So from the 1920s to the 1980s, you get an enormous period of church building. Not a lot in the 20s. A lot in the 20s, nothing from very little in the 30s and up to 1945, then a burst of church building into the suburbs and so forth. One of the things that began in the teens and the 20s, though, that stays with us all the way through the 80s is the idea that a church is not just a sanctuary, and the pastor's study is not just in the pastor's home next to the church, which had been the kind of dominant model, but the church was to follow an institutional church model. That is, a church was to become a hybrid of a church and a YMCA, YWCA. A lot of activities were going to happen at the seven-day-a-week church for youth, for adults, for elderly people, for spiritual events like Bible study, and for social events like softball clubs. So the scope and scale of what we think of as church during this long period of 1920 to 1980 got much, much larger. So in the sense, what you had to finance to have a church, as most people thought of a church, got bigger. And then, then for many cities, I'm from Detroit, which might be a paradigm of this, as some cities began to empty out to suburbs, some of that built-up capital was abandoned and left behind, although not all. Many times there was a remnant congregation with a big old church it didn't abandon with elderly members, and new churches being established in the suburbs with under the same brand or with new non-denominational or evangelical upstart brands. So it's a huge situation of bigger barns, as I call them, being created throughout the period, and the number of churches proliferating.
One of the things that you note, and I want to move us up into the 1980s here as we're running out of time, but your Real Clear Religion article, you noted that this year is the 50th anniversary of the automated teller machine. Most of us are thinking about the 500th anniversary of Luther and the Protestant Reformation, but here we're talking about ATM machines being around for 50 years, which I'm actually old enough to remember when they first came out, but I never really remember them becoming a thing until probably the early 1980s for where I grew up. And I never really had, I don't think, a debit card until the late 1980s, maybe even into the 1990s, because I'm a checkbook and cash kind of guy. But kids today, they don't carry coins. They're all about plastic. What kind of changes occurred from the 1980s up until present that is affecting church finance today?
Well, one would be the installation of these ATMs in some churches because of the importance of putting something in the plate. I've gotten a lot of snide comments about the article that churches like cash because they can hide it. It's easy to not report it and so forth and so on for the pastors to steal it, which is a very interesting sort of snarkiness of the internet. I think it's deeper. It goes to the materialization of actually taking some of your hard-earned money out of ones and zeros on the interbank network and putting it into cold hard cash and putting it in the plate as a symbolic act. But other things that have begun happening more and more is regular giving through automatic debiting from one's checking account. We direct deposit, and so we direct deposit into our churches as a means of support. That's happened more on sort of the liberal end of Christianity. What we're now seeing, and this part of the article got cut, is millennial-centric congregations are open to giving the way millennials exchange money. So there are Venmo and PayPal-friendly churches now, which I find interesting because their meaning of money isn't tied to cash. They're giving to their church the way they exchange money when it's time to settle up a bill with their friends at the coffee shop.
Yeah, I just find this very fascinating. We had an interview with Pastor Ron Osborne several years ago. He runs a mega church down in Southern California or maybe mid-California area. And he was the first one to point this out to me. I never thought about this, is that when we pass the collection plate, I'm so used to pulling out a 20 and tossing it in there. But then he pointed out that, yeah, millennials don't have cash. And I start asking some of my students, how many of you have a couple dollars in your wallet? Nobody said, no, what's a dollar bill? We don't know what that is. But as Pastor Osborne pointed out, he said this actually turned out to be a kind of a beneficial thing for congregations because this automated debit or this PayPal thing actually helped to smooth out the cycles of giving throughout the year. Obviously, Christmas and Easter is really big times, but in midsummer, a lot of congregations are saying, "Where's the cash? We're a little short here." But if you have automatic debit every week, every couple weeks, it smooths everything out. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, and cash flow has been a huge summer cash flow has been a huge problem for churches for a very long time. I remember my dad watching where they were in June before school went out and saying, we're going to be okay. the one little fixture that I think is interesting of where we never seem to go and where people had very strong feelings was, do you take credit cards for pledges and gifts? And a lot of clergy across the Protestant spectrum, liberal to conservative, didn't want to do it, and because, A, I think credit means it's not psychologically your money until you've paid for it. And the other reason is, pastorally, they had worked with so many people in deep credit card difficulties that to encourage people to use credit cards was to maybe implicate themselves in something, and the church in something that they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah. Interesting thoughts there. There's so much other thing. There's so many other things going on in your book. You have a chapter about pastors' wives and all these things, and it's a great read. So we're going to recommend people to your book. It'll be linked up at our website. But I want to wrap all of this up here with the last few minutes we have together, and return to your biography that I presented at the opening of our interview, and note that you're not just an academic, but you're also in the trenches of the religious realm as a Presbyterian minister, along with your wife. So, a personal question here, how has doing all this research from the point in time you started it with the Lilly Endowment and in writing this book, how has that affected how you go about your ministry, if at all? Have you learned anything over the past couple decades in studying all of this stuff that's changed the way you've looked at the world?
Well, so the book on Generous Saints Congregations Rethinking Ethics and Money is one of my answers to that, which is to say a greater candor with oneself as a leader and inside a congregation about why you're doing what you're doing, that can be fully faithful but also not practicing the fun and games and even willful self-deception so as to keep a church going is a way of greater integrity. So when I go out and because of what I've done, I'm often asked to come and preach a stewardship season sermon. I tend to go with a more candid what is this worth to you and why kind of approach rather than to spiritualize and avoid the conversation of materializing what this means to the people in the pew. They're there for a reason, so examining that is not a betrayal of their presence.
At some point in time, I'm going to have to hear this sermon from you, because I know at the churches that I've been at, one of the most uncomfortable periods of time is when the plate is passed, and how the pastor might dance around this, like, well, you know, we're really not about money, but on the other hand, I need to eat this week. It's kind of interesting just to have somebody come out and say, listen, this is an organization that needs to fund itself. If we're valuable to you and you want us around in the next few months, you gotta put something down. You gotta lay some of your own, put some of your own skin in the game, so to speak, there. So
I generally start with Genesis 1. It was all, God called it good several times and had it all set up before human beings arrived. It's the Hebrew Bible's way of putting human beings in their and all their striving in their place. And it's good to remember to be grateful.
Yeah. That is an excellent lesson. Always good to be grateful and to exchange with others, to give what you can and provide for others. A great mm-hmm. message to finish off. My guest today has been James Hudnut Boimler. Jim, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
My great pleasure. Thanks for talking with me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.